Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Welcome to the brightest audience in the country. I'm Fred Williams, host of Real Science Radio. And I'd like to welcome back Doug McBurney of the Weekly Worldview.
Thank you, Fred. I just want to bring the audience into the Wayback Machine with me because I remember many years ago listening to Bob Enyart Live, and over the course of a year or two, it just started to develop. He started to do science, and then it got a little more regular, and then pretty soon he was doing whole segments on science. Before long, it would take up a whole show. And then by the summer of 2006, Real Science Radio was born.
Yes, and I remember that pretty well, actually, for being, 16 years ago. And I had met Bob at a debate between him and another guy at Maranatha, an expert in the Hebrew language, and this Old Earth Creation group that was mostly from a group up in Boulder. So Bob and I met for the first time after that debate, and we became friends. And over the course of time, Bob invited me to do a radio show with him. At the time, I was the webmaster for the Creation Research Society. And what we decided to do was start going through some of the Creation Research Society quarterlies and talk about creation. And what an honor that was, and how that all started was really cool. We decided we're going to come up with a name for our show that's going to be in contrast to NPR's Science Friday, So we came up we came up with Real Science Friday. And as we talked about in a prior show, we eventually changed the name to Real Science Radio because Ira Flatile didn't like the fact that we had climbed to number two whenever you did a search for Science Friday. We were right behind his show.
Ira Flatow's offense was something of a badge of honor in and of itself.
It really was. And so we ended up settling because it was more cost-effective for us. Obviously, we don't have the mega dollars to go out and defend that, but we were appreciative of Ira Flatow giving us all this publicity. We were in the Denver Post business section, the LA Times,
Indeed.
The New York Post, all over the country, actually. And we were convinced it really helped our numbers a lot. So anyways, Doug, last week we talked about maybe we should play a rerun of the very first RSR show. And I think that was a great idea.
I think we should let it roll with the very first Real Science from the summer of 2006.
Well, not to worry, here's Bob in your life.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Well, for years, NPR, National Public Radio, they've done their Science Friday program. And beginning today, in just about 3 minutes, we're going to do our Real Science program once a quarter when the Creation Research Society's journal comes out. It's a quarterly scientific journal, and we'll have in studio for these programs the Real Science Friday shows on Bob Enyart Live. We'll have the webmaster of the Creation Research Society, Fred Williams. So that'll be a lot of fun. We'll start that in just a few minutes. But first, this Chicago judge, we become aware of any developments. Now to our Real Science first inaugural program. Fred Williams, welcome to Bob Enyart Live.
Thanks, Bob. It's an honor to be here.
It's so great. We've been friends for years through this radio and back when it was a TV show. And you, Fred, the audience may not know, I've mentioned your name occasionally on the air because you have a fabulous website that you run. Now, you're the webmaster for Creation Research Society, and that's a great website. There's a lot of powerful information there. But tell us about your own private website.
Okay, I started that in about 1998. It's called evolutionfairytale.com, and you can go there and get satire on evolution, and plus some serious articles. We've got a forum that we have there. And again, a lot of it's there's a lot of humor there, so you can go through a lot of the series, and some of the humor that I have there actually I got from Bob's TV show ideas.
Well, it's just a great website, evolutionfairytale.com, and I recommend people to check it out. They'll enjoy it. But then you're also the webmaster for a very prestigious organization called the Creation Research Society. And about how many members and how many degreed scientists are members of Creation Research Society?
Okay. First of all, the CRS has been around since 1963. It was started by 10 like-minded scientists who were interested in creation and wanted to start an organization where they could start publishing a peer-reviewed science journal. Because of the biases against creation scientists in the secular world, they wanted a means where they could publish their articles.
Yeah. Now, no matter how much evidence there is that shows that the Darwinian theory of evolution is invalid, our secular scientific journals, they simply will not consider contrary evidence. They ignore it. And so scientists that see the horrendous holes with Darwinian evolution, basically they get shunned. They can't publish on any topic. They just can't publish. So a peer-reviewed journal, that's what we have in our hands here, right? This is the Creation Research Society Quarterly, and I've got one here from December 2005 and another from March 2006. And what does that mean, peer-reviewed?
Okay, so an author who wants to have his article published will submit it, and it will be peer-reviewed by scientists at CRS. And so to get back to your question about the members, so there's 1,700 sustaining members. We have 700 voting members, and those are the members that have advanced scientific degrees.
So 700 members are scientists with advanced, like PhDs or masters, in any of the branches of the physical sciences.
Exactly.
And so they are the voting members of CRS.
That's right. And their degrees are from highly accredited universities, everything from Harvard to Penn State, highly qualified scientists.
And then there's another 1,000 members or so who cannot vote.
They cannot vote, but they, as members, they'll get the same privileges as far as receiving the quarterly journal. Mm-hmm. There's a bi-monthly newsletter that comes out that's very useful also, that keeps you up to date on some of the more news stories, things like that, and you get some other articles in there. It's a really nice newsletter.
All right. So what I thought we would do is every quarter when a new journal comes out, it's called the Creation Research Society Quarterly, CRSQ, you and I could do a Real Science Friday program and talk through what's in the journal at a level I think that the average person listening can understand, even if they're not a scientist. I'm not a scientist. Now, you've been presenting scientific slideshows and talks for quite a few years now on creation evolution in the Denver area mostly?
Yeah, that's right. I've had a few out-of-state appearances, but mostly in the Denver area, high schools, teacher conferences, churches.
And you've been involved with Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship for years. And in fact, I don't know if you were the one that got me the invite to speak there, December 2004, I think it was. And what a great time we had. You and I co-presented the debate that I did along with a science teacher from Maranatha Christian Center, Don Daly, on the age of the earth with the Denver chapter of Hugh Ross's Reasons to Believe group. And what a fun debate that was.
Oh, that, it was great.
Yeah.
In fact, I would highly recommend. I think you have that on DVD, right, Bob?
Yeah, actually, it's on an MP3 CD, so people could pop it into a computer or a DVD player or an MP3 player and listen to about a 2.5-hour moderated debate. And if they put it on, in their computer, they could also look at all the science slides that went along with the debate. It's really fun. Age of the Earth debate, and it's got a beautiful cover on it, and it's great to share with others who think that the Earth is billions of years old. All right, so since we're talking about just with that, how old the Earth is, and since you're familiar with how to present things to an audience that's not very technical, Fred, I'd like to start first with one of the last articles in the December 2005 issue of CRSQ, Creation Research Society Quarterly. It was about the Big Bang. And, of course, we've been arguing against the Big Bang for a long time. And this article advocates something that creationists have been advocating. They say, you know, the Big Bang presents a universe that has no center. There's no center and no boundaries. And that seems to be unreasonable. And there seems to be good reason to argue for a universe that does have a center. And in this article, one of the objections against the Big Bang theory is that it's been claimed, and this is central to the whole Big Bang theory, that at the moment of the Big Bang and in the first milliseconds, it was way smaller, the whole universe that it is right now. But they said even back then it was boundless. And then it kept getting bigger and bigger. And that seems to be a fundamental contradiction of logic and reason, that it could be boundless when it was small, but it keeps getting bigger. That's just one weakness with the Big Bang that this article titled Of Cosmic Proportions identifies.
That's right. The author of this article has many interesting quotes in there from evolutionists. For example, it shows their presuppositions. One evolutionist wrote that this relationship, which would eventually be known as Hubble's Law, suggested one of two things. Either the Milky Way was the center of the universe with every other galaxy speeding away from it.
Right.
A preposterous idea is what the author wrote.
Preposterous.
Of course, to him it is, because that just might indicate that maybe there's some kind of design behind it.
Right. In other words, if God created the universe to be the home of our galaxy, the Milky Way, to be the home of our solar system, to be the home of our Earth, it just might be that he might put us somewhere near the center of the universe. But atheists don't like that. They don't like the thought that we might have a special place in this vast universe. So they say, no, there's no way that the Milky Way galaxy could be in the center of the universe. And they reject that, not based on observation, not based on scientific evidence, but based on their philosophical presupposition.
That's right. And they have to ignore evidence, just like Hubble observed originally, that galaxies are speeding away from us.
Yeah.
So to get around the problem, they claim that so imagine a balloon and you're a point on the surface of a balloon and the universe itself is expanding.
Right.
And so everything would look like it's going away from each other. So that's how they tried to explain the problem away.
And Edwin Hubble, who we have our Hubble telescope named after him, and he discovered these redshifts in the light coming from different galaxies. And he said, look, if the redshift turns out to be velocity, in other words, the galaxies are actually moving away from us, and that's why the light looks like a slightly different color. He said, if that's the case, then it's unavoidable. We have to admit we're at the center of the universe. But they didn't like that idea, so they invented this other concept that space itself was expanding. Not the space in the stars, not the space in the galaxies, but the rest of the space of the universe is somehow expanding. And so that's been their argument and central to the Big Bang.
That's right. And this author even admitted, this evolutionist said, this is even very hard to swallow, but at least it's in keeping with the Copernican principle, which is really an atheistic idea.
Right.
So
that there's no special place in the universe.
That's right.
The Copernican principle, even though Copernicus was a Christian.
A Bible-believing Christian.
Right, who helped to set the modern world straight, that the Earth revolves around the sun. We have a heliocentric solar system, so that's pretty cool. Now, Fred, one of my arguments against the old earthers, and I use this on the internet against an atheist named Zaketh in our Battle Royale 7 on theologyonline.com, was that when NASA sets their Hubble telescope and they look at further and further images, they call them deep field images of outer space, they think that they're going to find galaxies that are brand new because they're peering back billions of years in time. And I've argued no, when they developed those photographs, and this happened when I was on the air on TV, Bob and Yurt Live, NASA announces they're going to show their first deep field photo, and I predicted it's going to look like every other part of space. It's going to have galaxies just like anywhere else. And so they published a photo, and it looks exactly like any other photo of galaxies. So now there's more later development on this,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, just yesterday, there is a report, and you can go to space.com.
This is yesterday.
This is yesterday, June 8th. This article came out.
2006.
That's right. Maturity of farthest galaxy cluster surprises astronomers. And so one of the astronomers, one of the discovery team members, noted that this distant cluster appears to be full of old galaxies. In fact, They estimate that it has about 500 trillion stars, roughly the size of our sun, in this galaxy.
Wow.
And again, it has the appearance that it's already mature.
So what they believe is that the further away we look, we should be seeing galaxies that were being formed when the universe was relatively young, not 16 billion years old, but just a few billion years old. And so those galaxies should be different than the ones where their light only takes millions of light years to get to us. And so we creationists, you know, an ignorant pastor of a Bible church, conservative talk show host, says, no, when they develop those photos, those galaxies and galaxy clusters, they're going to look just like all the other galaxies because God created the whole universe, not billions of years ago, but recently, and he created it all at the same time.
That's right.
In the creation week.
And in that debate that you had against the Hugh Ross group in Denver, a great point is that they all have spiral arms. These galaxies all have spiral arms.
Well, but all the spiral galaxies
Exactly.
Millions.
What evolutionists didn't expect to see spiral galaxies the farther out they look, because over time, according to Newton's laws, those galaxies should wind up like a clock screw and they should be basically featureless. It's called the winding up problem. They're well aware of it and they have no solutions. In fact, during that debate, they couldn't offer an explanation for that.
No, and scientists have known for a long time that the rate of movement of the stars in the heart of the spiral galaxies is so different than the rate in the arms, and they're different in a way that they should deform rather rapidly. Within just millions of years, they should no longer look like those beautiful spirals that we see. And our prediction as young Earth creationists is that the galaxies, no matter how far away you look, you're going to see galaxies that look like normal galaxies because they did not evolve over billions of years. God created the universe, the earth, and mankind in the recent past, and he did it all in the 6 days of creation.
That's right.
Pretty neat.
It is. One more point I want to bring up on this before we go to the next article.
Yes, sir.
Is what's really neat about some of the recent findings with the Hubble telescope is quantized redshifts of galaxies. And what they've discovered is that galaxies are falling along a concentric circle around our galaxy.
This is powerful.
It is. It's very powerful.
Yeah.
So imagine a dartboard, and we're the center of the dartboard, and as you go out farther on these concentric circles, galaxies are lining up on those circles. Farther out you go, you come to another concentric circle, and galaxies tend to line up on those. Now, how does the Big Bang explain that?
If the universe was isotropic and homogeneous, then they say there would not be a center of the universe, no matter where you were. There would not be edges or boundaries to the universe. And if that were the case, when we're here on Earth looking at galaxies far away, they would not have these quantized redshifts that indicate that we are in the center of these galaxies as we're mapping them so far.
Exactly. There's powerful evidence that we are actually at the center of the universe.
Which is pretty cool. And of course, the atheists hate it because why would that be? That suggests that man has some special position in the eyes of the Creator. And the famous astrophysicist in England, his name is Stephen Hawking. Stephen Hawking said that man is insignificant. Insignificant. And that's despicable. You know why? If a child is left to die, that's a great tragedy. One child has tremendous eternal significance. And mankind as a whole, the atheist, the evolutionist, they say we are insignificant. And so if you slaughter 6 million Jews, what's the difference? If you're atheistic, evolutionist, Germans, what's the difference? The whole human race is insignificant. And that's what that atheistic worldview leads to. It undermines morality and human dignity. So, Fred, could we look at the journal, the Creation Research Society Quarterly, for March 2006? And in each journal, there's usually about a half a dozen articles and book reviews, and they're so great. Oh, and by the way, we want to tell the audience, we want to encourage people to subscribe to this journal. That's one of the goals of these programs that we're going to do. And CRS, they're not paying us to advertise, are they, Fred?
No.
Or are you just holding that back from me? No, they're not. We came up with this idea because we're so excited about the scientific information in these journals. So this is what we came up with. If you, during the rest of this month of June, If you make a donation or buy something from Bob and Yart Live, crisis. But the goal is to get more people reading the articles by scientists about the evidence for creation. So that's exciting. And we might make money from it, too.
Yeah, highly recommend. It's a great journal.
It's a great journal. So go online to our website, kgov.com. Okay, now, Fred Williams, he's the webmaster for CRS. The March 2006 journal, there's an article in here starting on page 229. It is such a neat article. They point out that the evolutionist and the creationist, and when we speak of scientists who are atheists, they believe the earth is billions of years old, just to simplify things, we call them evolutionists because they do believe that the geologic processes evolved gradually also, and they believe that stars evolved and galaxies. So we just call them all evolutionists, even if we're not speaking about biological evolution. Is that fair?
Yes.
Fair. Plus, they're all evolutionists anyway. So the evolutionist and the creationist agree about these white pebbles, these little stones in Florida. Fred, have you been to Florida?
Several times on family vacations.
Yeah, us too, starting from when I lived in New Jersey. Probably been there 15 times, I'd say. So many of our relatives have condos in Florida, Palm Beach. Well, you know, real neat place. And when you go there, it's so easy to find these little white stones. They're great for picking up and skimming on a lake. Or, you know, there's trillions of these little rocks. And both the creationist and the evolutionist agree what the source of these pebbles are, these white stones. They say that in northern Florida, southern Georgia, there was an uplift, and that geologic uplift produced these stones. Now, and both agree that water carried these stones about 650 miles from northern Florida right to the Florida Keys. The difference is that the evolutionists say that took millions of years. The creationists say it happened, what? Rapidly. And this article, this is a technical article, and it shows the evidence. It shows, in fact, there are pictures of these stones, and you see they come from Lake County, Florida, and from Polk County, Florida, and from Glades County, Florida, like the Everglades. And the stones all look basically the same, same size, same composition, basically the same stones. And the creationists point out, if it took millions of years to get these stones 650 miles down the peninsula of Florida, then the stones at the tip of Florida would be smaller. There would be way greater weathering of the stones, chemical erosion of the stones, mechanical water and grinding, and the stones would be smaller. The ones that are 650 miles away that took millions of years to get there, yet the stones are all about the same size. And that's an argument against it taking millions of years for those stones to get through the state of Florida.
That's right, because the uniformitarian assumption is that the particle size should diminish the farther south you go, and that just isn't what we've observed.
Right. It's not. And so that's a great article. I mean, there are so many issues like that that are easy to understand. Now, somebody reads the article and they might realize, wow, you got to be a geologist to understand this. But in my experience, if you get a science journal and you want to read it and you read it and you only understand some of it, the next issue, when you read that, you'll understand more. And you're actually going through an education where you're learning more and more about basic science as you read the articles.
And there's a lot of articles about the geologic processes that really support a global flood. In fact, geologists, I've talked to geologists who say that Mount St. Helens erupting overturned 90% of uniformitarian assumptions because Mount St. Helens carved out a canyon, 100-foot wall canyon.
Engineer's Canyon.
Exactly.
In fact, a system of canyons.
And what does it have running down the middle of it now from Spirit Lake?
A stream.
Yes, but that I'm sure that if an evolutionist woke up from a coma, that stream would have carved that thing out pebble by pebble over millions of years.
Right. If you showed a photograph of Engineer's Canyon to a geologist and say, how did this canyon get here? He would say, that stream created the canyon. Well, we know the canyon was created within hours by Mount St. Helens, and the canyon created the stream. The stream did not create the canyon.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
This article about the geological process in Florida reminded me of, you asked when we had been to Florida before. The first time we went there, we just like all tourists like to do, you go down the beach and you pick up shells and you bring them back to your room. Well, after a little while, our room started to smell.
Yeah.
And, well, what it is because some of the shells we picked up, some of the clams we picked up, they were still alive because
they were closed.
They were closed. So so we didn't know that. We didn't know that when they die, they open.
Yeah, when you live in Colorado, we don't have much coastline, right?
Exactly. There's not too much.
No.
So
you go to the beach, you collect these shells, they're closed, and then they start stinking.
That's right.
They stinketh because you've now taken them out of their habitat. They die in the shell and they stink.
That's right.
What does that teach us?
Well, what's interesting about that is virtually every major mountain range, in fact, about anywhere you want to look in the world, you can find marine fossils buried everywhere. You can go to Home Depot and you can find marine life in the gravel. Yeah, what's interesting, I've got road cuts out of a place in Cincinnati that's all marine life, just filled into these different road cut pieces I grabbed. And invariably, most of the time, clams and sea life are typically in a closed position.
They're closed, which means what?
And what does that tell you? It tells you they were buried alive.
Trillions of clams in the fossil record are closed, meaning that they were buried rapidly, which is so absolutely neat, because what evolutionists want people to believe is that fossil forming is a normal occurrence. It's not a normal occurrence. Where in the world today are fossils being formed on a normal basis? It's not. It requires a catastrophic environment. So the global flood buried trillions of organisms, including clams. If the clam just died and fell to the bottom of the sea and was covered, it would have opened up. The clam inside would have been eaten by some other creature, and you'd have a fossil of two pieces of the clam open. But we find, I said trillions, it's billions upon billions.
Oh, yeah. It's
probably trillions of clams that were fossilized. They were buried rapidly, and they did not have the time to die before they were buried and then fossilized.
That's right.
Right. That's pretty cool. You're listening to Bob and Yurt Live, our website, kgov.com. And anyone who makes a donation or orders some of our Bible materials or videos from Bob and Yurt Live, so that's an offer and our goal. Fred Williams and I, we want more people to read this great scientific evidence. So now, Fred, this article is about brain size. And could you explain what the evolutionists claim to start with?
Okay, their basic premise is that the increasing brain capacity from Lucy, which is Australopithecine, which means southern ape. A lot of people have heard of Lucy. As Lucy evolved into another ape creature, Homo habilis, and then on up to Homo erectus and Homo sapien, that the brain capacity continued to get larger. And it's a ratio. It's not really – the brain itself is not necessarily getting bigger.
But compared to the body size.
Compared to the body size – brain size is known to have a strong correlation with body size. I think most scientists agree that there is a general correlation there. And when you look at mammals, what the issue is the ratio of the amount of brain capacity compared to the body size. It tends to be that if you have a higher ratio of the brain capacity compared to the body size, you're generally considered more intelligent. Mm. So it's not a direct correlation.
As mammals go.
Now,
as far as human beings, if you have a physics course in college with 10, say, girls from Japan and 10 football players from Iowa, and the guys, their heads are almost twice as big as the girls,
they're not
going to score better. They're not smarter.
No.
So it doesn't hold up.
It's more of an intraspecies. You're talking interspecies. This is more...
Right. Among Homo sapiens, among human beings, there's no correlation between brain size and intelligence. But generally, among different species, as a species, their brain gets larger, they do tend to have more intelligence that they can exhibit.
That's right. And it's called... encephalization quotient, and if you've heard of encephalitis, that's inflammation of the brain. It's a viral infection.
Like water on the brain, a baby
exactly.
might be born with that.
And so So evolutionists try to claim that as you go from Australopithecines, which is Lucy, up to Homo habilis, that there's a 50% increase in this ratio, this brain capacity. Let's just call it that to keep things simple. And then as you go to Homo erectus, you have another increase on up to Homo sapiens. But what the author of this article points out is that they're assuming that the Australopithecines and Homo habilis are human-like. So they're basing all their estimates on human models and not ape models. Mm. But we know from science, and many evolutionists agree with this as well, that the Australopithecines were basically tree climbers.
Yeah, they would swing in the trees, and that's accepted, I think, by the vast majority of evolutionist scientists, that Lucy was able to swing in the trees.
That's right, and that's called brachiating. And so if you use that model, what happens is that quotient that we talked about before, that brain capacity, puts the Australopithecines and Homo habilis in the same category as modern apes and modern chimpanzees. It puts them in the same range of category, and they're not in the range of humans. And it totally invalidates their argument. But they, again, start from the assumption that evolution is true, and so they're assuming from the get-go that Lucy is basically a human ancestor. Basically, they're trying to make a monkey out of a human.
Right. So if I could understand this article, I've read it also, that when they try to figure out the brain size of Australopithecine and Homo habilis, they said, look, we see the brain size is getting bigger relative to the body size, which shows us they're evolving toward humans. But in order to make that claim that the brain size, the ratio was getting bigger, they used a false observation. They assumed that Lucy did not swing in trees. They assume that she only walked upright.
That's right.
And that changes the structure of the body of the ape, and then you would get the wrong brain capacity. And so when you correct for that, as the vast majority of evolutionists believe, that Lucy and Homo habilis, that they did swing in trees, when you correct for that, it turns out that that increased brain capacity disappears. In fact, there was no increased brain capacity ratio-wise.
Exactly. What it did, it increased the body mass because in order to swing through trees, they have more upper body mass. When you account for these characteristics, the numbers came well within. Right. Homo habilis and Australopithecines were virtually indistinguishable from each other and from modern apes. Hmm.
Then there's a book review in this Creation Research Society Quarterly. This is the March 2006 edition, and on page 251, there's a book review on Lord Kelvin, who is a scientist, a creationist. In fact, we speak of degrees Kelvin in honor of him. He's one of the fathers of thermodynamics, which is a foundational science, absolutely foundational to much of the rest of science. And in this short book review, it's pointed out that Kelvin, even though he did most of his work and writing for a half century after Darwin published Origin of the Species, he completely rejected evolution, whether it was theistic evolution or secular or naturalistic evolution. He rejected it. And Fred, there are so many of the fathers of the natural sciences who reject evolution and believe that God created man and the earth.
And that's right. Evolutionists will try to perpetuate the myth that creation isn't science, yet they say that not knowing or unaware that almost all the major branches of science have at their foundation fathers. The fathers of science are all Christian scientists, such as Kepler.
Yeah.
You could go on and on. Louis Pasteur.
Yeah. I put together a list, Fred, of the fathers of the natural sciences. We put together this list here at Bob and Yurt Live from our own research into the writings of these scientists. And here's an example of scientists who believed that God created the earth and the universe and man. Copernicus. He's pretty much the father of the scientific revolution and astronomy. Francis Bacon, father of the scientific method. Johann Kepler, physical astronomy. Galileo, law of falling bodies. Then we have William Harvey, circulatory system. Robert Boyle, chemistry. We have Isaac Newton, gravity, color, strong Christian scientist. We have John Dalton, the father of atomic theory. But then, Fred, all these people who I've just mentioned, all these fathers of the physical sciences, do you recall if they came before or after Darwin?
Those were all before Darwin.
And that's what the atheists say. They say, yeah, those scientists, they were great, but they lived before Darwin. He published his Origin of Species in 1859. And they say if they only lived after, they would have all agreed, because all educated people after Darwin agree with biological evolution. Well, the list continues. It doesn't stop there. And the fathers of the natural sciences who did their work, their research, and wrote after Darwin continued to reject evolution. And does this prove, if someone rejects evolution, does that prove it's false? No, it doesn't prove that. But if all these fathers of the natural sciences, if they reject evolution, it proves that the evolutionists are wrong when they claim that only ignorant people reject evolution.
Yeah, it's the illusion that you often read, for example, in the newspaper about science versus religion. And it's really, evolution is not a science, but they try to paint it as science versus religion, that creation is just religion.
Right.
And
they mock us by saying it's either faith or science,
exactly.
Faith or facts.
And you see that a lot. And boy, this list here proves that, you know, we couldn't even be having this radio program if it wasn't for the technology that it was established by
creationists.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So after Darwin, then you have the fathers of natural sciences like these guys, like Michael Faraday, the father of electromagnetism, which only explains almost everything that happens in the universe. Minus gravity and nuclear forces. Then you have Mendel, Gregor Mendel. He's the father of
genetics.
They even call it Mendelism and the laws of Mendel. Then you have the father of microbiology, Louis Pasteur. Pretty brilliant. These guys rejected Darwin, rejected evolution.
Even and Wernher von Braun, rocket science.
Rocket science. We have James Joule and Lord Kelvin. We're talking about Kelvin. They're the fathers of thermodynamics. They discovered the first and second laws of thermodynamics. They rejected evolution and Darwinian biological evolution. Joseph Lister, the father of modern surgery. That's where we get Listerine from. George W. Carver. That's George Washington Carver, right? He's the father of modern agriculture. Even the fathers of aviation. You know who that would be?
I think that'd be the Wright brothers.
Yeah, the Wright brothers.
I was right?
Yeah, you were right. And a couple guys who are alive today, like the discoverer of MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, that has helped millions of people be diagnosed and live better lives. And that's Raymond Damadian.
And unfortunately, he should have got a Nobel Prize for it, but his coworkers did, but he didn't.
And he was rejected, I believe, he was rejected because he's an outspoken creationist. And he's the one who discovered and invented the technology behind MRI, magnetic
exactly.
resonance imaging, but the Nobel organization is harshly anti-Christian, anti-creationist, and so they discriminated against him because he's a fundamentalist Christian, which was tragic. But then also John Baumgartner, one of the most brilliant geologists in the world.
And featured on Time Magazine.
Time Magazine. He wrote the program called Terra, which geologists around the world use to understand how the surface, the crust of the earth functions, for example, during earthquakes. And Baumgartner, he's just a brilliant guy, and I love to read his stuff.
Oh, and you've left tons of names that we could keep going through.
So many of the greatest scientists before Darwin and after Darwin rejected Darwinian evolution or believed that God created the universe, our solar system, and our earth and mankind. For example, you know, Descartes, Rene Descartes, that French guy, all messed up guy, he suggested that the solar system, this is in the 1600s, that the solar system was formed by a gas cloud that was swirling, and it condensed, and it formed the sun and the planets. Now, that was quite an idea, right? Isaac Newton commented on that. And Isaac Newton, who helped us first to grasp the concept of gravity, probably, well, he's considered the most brilliant scientist to to ever live. Isaac Newton said, no, Descartes was wrong. In fact, his quote is that Descartes, his hypothesis about the swirling gas cloud forming our solar system, he said it is plainly erroneous. And he said, let me read here. Newton said the solar system, quote, must have been the effect of counsel, that is intelligence, nor is there any natural cause which could give the planets those just degrees of velocity in proportion to their distance from the sun and other central bodies, which were requisite to make them move in such concentric orbs about those bodies. I know of no reason for the motion of the planets, but because the author, capital A, the author of the system thought it convenient. And Isaac Newton wrote that, and that's a good example of so many of the fathers of the physical sciences who believe that God made the universe, our solar system, the Earth, and mankind.
Yeah, and when man starts from the presupposition that evolution is true, you get bad science. When they actually try to do science based off of that, for example, how many people listening today had their tonsils removed based on the false science that they're vestigial organs? So today they're not so quick to take them out if they're infected, but boy, 20, 30 years ago, based on evolutionary thinking.
Now, vestigial organs, they're organs that evolutionists said we have things in our bodies, like they used to think the pituitary gland had no function, or your appendix, or your tonsils, or really there were dozens of organs, tissues in our body that evolutionists said were left over from when we were apes, or when we evolved from fish or whatever. And turns out, well, we didn't evolve from some other species, so that interpretation was wrong. So evolution directly led to bad science in that instance.
Exactly.
I like to ask people, what has the theory of evolution actually given us? For example, when you make a true scientific observation like gravity, like Isaac Newton helping us to understand the properties of light and color, when you make those kinds of true scientific discoveries, they typically produce extraordinary benefits. And we have thousands, tens of thousands of products that improve the standard of living of billions of people around the world because of all these discoveries. What has been invented or discovered because of the theory of evolution?
And I've asked the same question on forums, on my website, and you get nothing, dead air basically.
I've asked that question for years, and there might be somebody out there in Radioland who has a suggestion. There might be an evolutionist who says, I know what we've discovered because of evolution. What? We discovered you could breed from a dog, you could breed a horse. No, we discovered the opposite, that there are genetically defined limits to a species, to the kinds that God created. And you can't continue to breed in some extreme direction because genetics don't allow you to. So many of the things that evolution made scientists suppose have turned out to be exactly wrong. So what have we now created that we couldn't have unless we figured out evolution? I think the answer is nothing.
That's right.
But I'm open to some suggestion. Okay, so Fred, where do we go from here? We talked about the fathers of the sciences on that book review in CRS, in Creation Research Society Quarterly. They did a book review on a book on Lord Kelvin.
Okay.
How about we touch on the December issue had an article about Lucy and whether or not she was bipedal, whether she walked upright.
Okay. Well, that was an article by Marvin Lubinow as an update, and it was based on a report in the August 2005 Scientific American that suggested that the fossil reconstruction of the australopithecines, of the foot of the australopithecines,
of Lucy,
was based on a mixture of fossils. What they tried to do is that, and this ties in with the Laetoli footprints that they found that were remarkably human. But But they dated the volcanic ash that they were found in to 3.7 million years, so they assumed that they were left by the australopithecines. Mm. But they had very little evidence to support that other than finding human-like footprints. So they tried to put human footprints on an ape, trying to make a human out of an ape.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Lubinow points out in this article, wondering, is this deception here? Why has it been so long since we've heard this evidence? about this fossil reconstruction. And it's, he said that it's hard for me to, an outsider, to know whether or not this is a case of outright deception.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the pun that he had. For evolutionists, it's just a short step from science to science fiction.
Yeah, right. And he refers to a report in Scientific American, August 2005, that suggests that there might be a problem here. And if they're reconstructing Lucy, they're building her, and they're using bones from different species, from Australopithecus afarensis, and then from Homo habilis, that's pretty terrible. And this should be extremely open from the beginning, but it's apparently not.
That's what seems to be the case.
Yeah, and Lubinow, in his, he has a great classic book, doesn't he?
Bones of Contention, and he has an update to that book in 2004. The original copy was 1992. And his 2004 includes additional material, for example, on the mitochondrial DNA in Neanderthals that evolutionists and old earthers tried to claim proved that the Neanderthal wasn't as closely related to humans as much as the science indicates that they are.
He's a great source of scientific information. Oh, by the way, our call screener just told me somebody called in from Indiana and ordered 5 plots. My manuscript, The Overview of the Bible. So we're excited about that. And anyone who orders anything from Bob and Yurt Live through the month of June or makes a donation, just request it and we'll get you. All right. So Lucy, there's seems time and time again with hominid fossils, there's deception, there's significant things that we're not told. Well, also in this December 2005 copy of this journal, there's an article at the end about the dating, radiometric dating, and they want to remind us of all the known errors when they do, for example, potassium-argon dating. That's one of the main ways they date things that are supposedly millions or billions of years old. And they point out in this article, and these are not contested observations, these are known facts even by the atheist scientists, that when they date things like Mount St. Helens, the lava dome created in 1986, they date it as old as 2.7 million years. How old is it really? It's 20 years.
20 years.
We got video of it. And they date it with potassium argon. They said 2.7 million. There's eruptions in Hawaii like in 1800, 1801 that's historical eruptions. We know the days they erupted, and they date rocks in the magma at 2.9 billion years old.
And yeah, why should we expect to believe dates where we can't date rocks where we know the age, and we're expected to believe the dates of rocks that they date? They're supposedly millions and millions of years old.
Yeah, and there's this European mineralogist, a professional mineralogist, Dr. Marie-Claire von Osterwich. That's a mouthful. Dr. Marie-Claire von Osterwich, and she was involved in many interdisciplinary trips to Africa with scientists, and she said, we went thinking that we're going to find evidence for the emergence of man from apes. She said, well, that was a complete failure. On the other hand, there was overwhelming evidence that a massive flood carved the whole surface of Africa. And she said, that was interesting. And then she pointed out that these dates, these bad dates that they get when they do potassium argon on something from Mount St. Helens or Hawaii, and they say they're millions or billions of years old when they're not. She said, when they date the fossils that they take out of Africa and the sediments, the layers the fossils are in, she said, the same kind of problem is involved with those dates as we get from these known bogus dates. Therefore, the dates given that they're so many millions of years old are simply false. They're wrong. We shouldn't use them. And she offered to demonstrate her case by laboratory experiments showing that we know we can falsify this dating technique. And not only was she refused to work out the experiments she proposed, but then she was required to turn in her lab key. And that shows the bias and the prejudice of the atheist against those who, with hard data, say, look, this stuff is not working, and we think we know why.
It's really a religion. Evolution is a religion. And defend it tooth and nail. It's too bad to hear things like that.
Right, and the true believers will not allow discourse even on the topic. And we see that they try to shut down discussion among high school students of alternative views of origins. They're they won't allow it to be discussed because they're afraid of the power of the evidence for the creator.
And again, it's one of the reasons we have a journal like the Creation Research Society where scientists can publish in this journal and not be concerned, you know, be able to publish and have peer review of their material, something that cannot happen in the secular journals because they do not allow this contrary evidence to be presented.
So we've been talking to Fred Williams, who is the webmaster for Creation Research Society. And Fred, your website is evolutionfairytale.com. And it's funny. It's just great. Congratulations on that website.
Thank you.
And if anyone would like a of this fabulous scientific journal. So Fred Williams, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob. It was great.
It's so good. And the next journal is due in a few weeks.
The June edition should be coming out pretty soon.
Yeah, so we don't have to wait 3 months. So we'll be back shortly. God bless you guys.
So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed the very first ever Real Science radio show. So for Doug McBurney, this is Fred Williams of Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Hey, this is Dominic Enyart. Quick announcement. Will Duffy has his debate with Chris Date tonight on open theism. Does open theism best present the biblical data? It will be available on today's show page, rsr.org. That's Real Science Radio, rsr.org, for the open theism debate tonight at 5 p.m. Highly recommend you guys check it out. Hey, may God bless you guys.